Spring Media Substrates, and I'm pleased to introduce Dr. Paul Fisher, who's a professor at the Department of Environmental Horticulture at the University of Florida in Gainesville. So he just came over today to be with us and explain some of the work that he's been doing in research and practical applications of managing growing media and how it can impact your business as media producers. So, Paul?
Thanks very much, Robert. Well, good afternoon, everybody. It's very nice to be here.
G'day.
G'day to all of you. I'm trying to figure out what my accent is, but I don't know how aware of you are. The real sporting competition going on right now, the important one, is the Rugby World Cup going on in England. So I'm from one of the four semi-finals, sorry. So we're going to talk about quality control for greenhouse growing media. My goal is that everybody has something that you can take away from this afternoon that you can use in your business. And I know that some of you are going to be working with growing media for greenhouse applications, many for mulches, for nursery stock and containers, or even field production. But I think there's going to be some little nuggets of information that you can all use. I have put a copy of a handout with all of the slides on the end, if you can just pass those along. There's also a couple of my business cards on your table if anyone wants to follow up. I've got a research extension appointment at the university, so for the state of Florida, I'm the floriculture extension person, which basically means anything grown in a greenhouse I deal with. And so I'm not a true substrate person like Dr. Fontenot there, but I end up dealing with a number of aspects of root zone management, whether it's water quality, biofilm in your irrigation lines, plant pathogens, alkalinity, fertilizers, as well as growing media, and anything else that growers want me to deal with. So I'm not going to cover a lot of what we do with the greenhouse growers, but we do have a lot of protocols, and I'm going to give you some website links in there, that growers can use in their greenhouse operations to do some quality control, and if they're mixing their own media, or if they are, for example, measuring compaction in their trays and so on. But this, just to show you that some of the images that are up here and what the significance is there, we do a lot of work with propagation. So one of our issues here is wettability. You can see here a wettability issue where water is ponding on the top of these alk pots. We do cost analysis for root substrates, whether it's worth having loose fill trays or a stabilized mix like this, where the root ball doesn't have to hold that growing media together. We do some very simple things like the middle picture there. There's a link in one of the websites I'll show you on different moisture levels for people who are taking your products, putting them into a hopper, and then filling trays or filling alpots to know basically with a simple hand test how moist the growing mix is. And we do a lot on irrigation management. So what this grower is doing on the right side there is just checking in the morning after propagating their cuttings whether they can see the individual dots on the floor underneath each cell that's an indicator that they're doing a good job of not applying too much water. So I'm just going to focus on two areas. We're not going to go into things from that grower perspective, but as I say, I'll give you some website links there. But I'm going to focus on training and online resources, and there's going to be some pieces there that I think that you might be able to use in your business. And then I just took one topic, one aspect of growing media that we'll go into in depth, and that's on pH management. So how many of you here in this room, just so I can get an idea, how many of you are producing greenhouse substrates for the greenhouse industry? Okay, how many for the nursery industry, where more field containers, okay? And how many of you are mixing limestone and media components together? Okay, so somewhere in half, okay. All right, well, let's take it from there. So what we're looking at in this image here This is Calico, which is like Virginia. You go along to Lowe's, Home Depot, whatever, you're going to see this plant, and it's supposed to be looking like this. This is a pH 5.2, and as pH goes up, we get our classic iron deficiency symptoms and an unsaleable plant. And so this is an iron inefficient crop here, not very efficient taking up iron, and shows these iron deficiency symptoms of high pH. And then in contrast, this is a seed geranium, which is a very iron efficient crop. It's evolved on calcareous soil, soils high in calcium, and it will drive pH down very quickly, takes up more cations than anions, and puts out acid into the soil, and accumulates iron and manganese to a toxic level. So we have problems at high pH for a lot of crops and low pH for some crops, and so pH management is therefore important. A little bit of an explanation about my program is we have a number of greenhouse companies as well as allied suppliers that work with me, and for about 12 years now we get together and set research priorities, and I'm sure we've got some, I know we've got some representatives from some of our allied operations. So our focus is very much on propagation, greenhouse, short-term kind of crops. But if we went 2 miles up the road, 2 hours up the road, and looked at what's in my research greenhouse at the moment, this is one of the projects that we have going, which is moisture sensors from Decagon, and we're using that to both automatically control irrigation on a number of crops, as well as with a weather station, just simply on monitoring moisture level. This is very good technology. You've probably seen moisture sensors for decades. Okay, we're at the point where we have moisture sensors out there now that are extremely reliable. This is actually going into a really crappy growing media, and it's going into a volcanic rock, which is the kind of substrate that's used in cutting producers in Guatemala, Kenya, Ethiopia to produce plant cuttings. And if you know anything about leaching fractions, basically what's proportion of what comes out the bottom of a container compared with what gets applied up to the top, then these growers overseas have got leaching fractions anywhere from 20%. So if I put on a gallon, 0.2 of a gallon would come out the bottom, through to 80%, okay? Meaning that almost everything's going out on the floor. And it's drip irrigation with high nutrient levels. So in that case, in a single farm, they're flushing, in some cases, more than $100,000 worth of fertilizer down the drain and into drinking water supplies. We also have a student who's working on measuring oxygen and propagation media, which is, you know, it's all about the balance between the substrate and then porosity, between water and air when it comes to rooting plants. And so it's very easy to measure moisture level, which is what we're doing here. We have a logging scale here. Again, if you're interested in that technology, we can take this for about $900. There's a scale that you can put out into a nursery, and it will track the weight of the container, which is almost all water. Over time, you can get a very good idea how your client is using irrigation water. And then what we're doing now is we're using a fiber optic technology that we can put a probe into a cell and measure the dissolved oxygen and oxygen in the air. And so one of the reasons that we're working on this particular project with measuring oxygen is that there are companies in the horticulture industry who are promoting oxygenation of irrigation water. And so as a grower, the idea would be, okay, well, I can get my oxygen to my roots by turning on a machine that's going to dissolve, supersaturate that irrigation water with oxygen. My basic working hypothesis in all of this is to tell growers that the best way to provide oxygen to your root zone is to have good quality substrate and don't overwater. Okay? Because you know, I can show that, for example, if we go from a propagation cell completely saturated where the grower's over applying water to just letting it drain and use the 5% or so air porosity in that mix, I've got about three times as much air, three times as much oxygen going into the root zone. So we're trying to help growers understand this air-water balance. And as you know, from the point of view of supplying substrates, It's always the problem with the growing media. It's always that fault of if there's a plant health problem, but so much of it comes down to how in our industry our customers are using water and using fertilizer. Another project going right now is looking at agrochemicals in water. So any of you who work with the turf industry, with greenhouses and nurseries, there's a plant growth regulator that's applied, Paclobutrazole. Some of the brand names would be Bonsai or Piccolo or Paxol. So it's used in turf on sports fields to keep the plants not having to mow as much, and for greenhouse production to keep plants nice and compact. Well, it has a half-life in water of around 6 months, and we apply it in the parts per million range, but it's active on certain crops in the parts per billion range. And so we're looking at a couple of technologies, carbon filtration and ozone, to remove some of those agrochemicals out of water, particularly for growers who are capturing and reusing that water. And then we've got about 20 different organic substrates from different companies that we're looking at the moment. And basically, there's always, there's several challenges with organic growing mixes. One of them is variability, consistency from one batch to another. Another one relates to the fertilizers that we have available for organic production, is that they tend to have a high peak of availability, and then that nutrient release tails off very quickly. And then another one is high pH. And so what happens is we put an organic mix into organic fertilizer into our growing mix, whether it's compost or some chicken manure-based product or whatever, is with microbial action, as it mineralizes the nitrogen, pH goes up and up and up. And so what will happen is, for example, as I say, we've got a bunch of commercial substrates, including from some people here in this room, is that within a couple of weeks, applying some organic fertilizer in one of these growing mixes, we get up to pH 7 very quickly, tomato plants or whatever, very rapidly show iron deficiency at high pH. So the need to reduce the lime incorporation rate. But there's a lot more interest right now in organic mixes than there was about 20 years ago, 10 years ago, when I was working on other projects. And medical marijuana industry is driving a lot of that interest, where we don't know what exactly the parameters are going to be for production, but we do a lot of tomato alternative research work, and even if it grows well with tomato, then you can use it for other things. Okay, so one of the I'm here for an hour or less, and I want to make sure that you go away with some resources that you can use. So one of them is this website, floriculturealliance.org. And if you go into grower resources in here, then you look at the list of topics that there is on the left-hand side. You'll find growing media and limestone in there. There's spreadsheets, there's articles, quite a lot of detail for those of you who want to go back to your operations and pass some things along to some of your testing R&D type departments. This is a good place to go for some of that information. So, for example, we're going to focus a little bit on limestone in here. Everything that I'm talking about regarding lime is available through that website. But I'm going to do some shameless promotion of some other things that I work on, okay? And one of them is backpocketgrower.org, where we have short videos and calculator apps. Some of those I think you'll find, or your customers will find, useful. And something that we've just started doing this year is 4-week-long certificate courses in English and Spanish, including related to fertilizer and nutrition topics. So if you've got your phone out, then just open up the browser and go to backpocketgrower.org. And it'll work on a desktop, but it's really designed for a mobile device. And you'll find in the bottom right, there's a little login button. You don't have to log in, but if you do log in with this password, then you'll have access to some extra resources on that website. Okay, so Gators 2015, And the two most important parts of this website are training and tools. So the training has got videos and fact sheets, including soil testing protocols. And the tools has got a few simple calculator apps. Okay, and some of those calculator apps are definitely going to be useful for your customers, okay, as well as any of you in your businesses where you're, for example, mixing up pesticides or fertilizers. So on the training resources side, we've got YouTube videos, we've got how to soil testing, many of those are in English and Spanish, and so, for example, we've got four different soil pH and EC testing methods in there. So to get to that, you click on training in the top right. And then on the tools side, we've got tools for making up pesticide and fertilizer sprays or solutions. We've got growing media use and testing apps. There's some on, there's a database of all of the technologies that are available for cleaning up water in terms of pathogens, algae, and bacteria. And then there's also some crop budgeting tools. And where this crop budgeting tools actually come in handy is you can do a very quick enterprise budget for how much it costs to produce any container crop. And included in there is the cost of the growing media. And it's very easy to show with a little sensitivity analysis in that app that it's very easy to pay for growing substrate, and it's a very minor part of the total cost of producing a product. So here's an example here of one of the apps. It's on how to do a dilution, and so I choose US units, a solid fertilizer. It's going to be 20-10-20. We're going to make up 100 parts per million of nitrogen. It's 20%. Nitrogen in 20-10-20, going to make up 100 gallons, and it's going to go through a 1-to-100 dilution injection ratio, dilution ratio, so how much product do you end up adding into the tank. Okay, so of all of the things that are on that website, every one of your horticulture customers can use this out in the greenhouse industry. And that's the idea behind the back pocket part of the back pocket problem. Okay, the other thing is the last page of your handout has got an example of one of the courses that we're running. And in all of the universities, we're kind of going through this agony of we're not attracting enough four-year students into our programs to feed what we need in our industry as it goes on in the future. But I think one of the challenges is that with the cost of paying people like me and Bill Fontenot and keeping universities running, and tuition costs going up, and parents look at that, students look at that, and then they look at some of the salaries in our industry, a lot of people who are going to come into our industry are not going to go through four-year programs in the future. Yeah, but we've got a lot of people in our industry, many of them Spanish-speaking, who have already shown to be very dedicated, got an extremely good work ethic, but they lack some of the knowing why behind some of their activities in your factory or in a greenhouse. And so what we're doing is we're 3 weeks into one of our courses right now on advanced nutrient management. All our courses run for 4 weeks. They cost $200. They're in English and Spanish. There's a live professor there that's there to answer questions. We give them deadlines. We grade their projects and give them feedback. They can access classes any time of day. They get a customized certificate. And it's really aimed at professional development. So maybe something for people within your business, as well as potentially for some of your customers. It's all delivered through, it's all online. So it's all delivered with some nice, easy to use software. It can be accessed from a phone or from a desktop, whatever. So these are the topics that we've got going for next year. The first three we've run through this year. About 40% of our people have been international. And around about, I'd say 20% of Spanish speaking is their first language. And so we have these courses coming up next year, and we're adding we in disease management for container grown crops. So again, something to consider. Where you get information, just go back to the back pocket grower under training, and it's got info in there. Okay, so any questions about any of those topics up to now? All right, yeah, it's nearing the end of your conference, so I'm just gonna blast on by then. Okay, you asked for it, you're now in class, all right? That was the fun stuff, and now we're getting into the technical stuff. All right, so I'm gonna go through some of one of these classes, and as I said, I thought I'll pick one technical topic. So this is actually most of one lesson out of eight that are in the current course that's going right now. And, okay, so you're going to be my students, so you know, sorry about that, but we're going to blast on through. And look at, I'm just going to show some of the aspects of pH management, especially related to limestone. And then we're going to go into matching your lime with your growing medium, okay, so that you can get the kind of pH that you want at the start of a crop, as well as maintaining it over time. So, I think everybody in this room has probably seen this graph. It's in every nursery and greenhouse horticulture management course. Thickness of the bar here, as we move from left from right, is the thickness of the bar is the solubility of the nutrient, right? And here we've got pH 4.5, very acidic, up to pH 7.5, very basic. And plant roots take up soluble forms of the nutrients. So, for example, if we've got iron as one of our nutrients that has low solubility at high pH, then it can be sitting in that container mix. You might put in, for example, iron sulfate, inorganic iron form. If we go up one pH unit, its solubility decreases by times 1,000. So once you get up above pH 6, then we run into iron deficiency. So too much, we run into toxicities low pH, too little at deficiencies at a high pH. But this is the kind of research work that I do in my lab. Is did you know that graph that we typically use is based on one growing mix and one fertilizer, and they got their different pH levels by adding more and more dolomitic limestone? Okay, why should you care about that? Well, it's just understanding how pH actually interacts with your components. Okay, so we take a simple idea and make it complicated. So we run multiple different substrates and fertilizer formulations. Okay, so here I'm just going to show you one example. If we go back to this graph, it shows calcium and magnesium being really soluble at high pH, right? Okay, so you run into calcium deficiency or magnesium deficiency, should you raise your pH? Well, the answer is no. And here we've got peat perlite mix. Okay, and most of what I do is working with peat-based mixes, but we do use other components in our substrates. But you would see the same relationship. Here we've got increasing pH. How do we do that? We added more and more either hydrated lime, calcium hydroxide, or magnesium hydroxide. And we had some fertilizer that had some calcium in it that we added into that mix. So what happens to calcium level as pH goes up? Well, of course it goes up if we're using calcium in our lime. If we're not, we're using magnesium, then the solubility of calcium actually goes down. Okay, so you've got a grower, gets in touch with you, I've got a calcium deficiency in my crop, raising pH will actually make the situation worse. Rather than just liming, using calcium nitrate or a soluble calcium form would be much more effective. Same kind of thing with magnesium. Here, if we use calcium hydroxide as our liming source, solubility of magnesium goes down. It only goes up if, of course, we're adding lots and lots of magnesium in our limestone. Okay, so again, if we have a magnesium deficiency, what do? We apply Epsom salts, magnesium sulfate, rather than raising pH. Okay, so that graph also uses iron from an inorganic form, okay, iron sulfate. And as I mentioned, the solubility here, this is a log scale, solubility of iron goes way down very quickly as pH goes up by a factor of 1,000 for each pH unit. But if we use chelated forms of iron, then we're going to see a very different relationship. So the most common chelate that we use is iron at EDTA. This is pH. This is the percentage of iron that is chelated. And so if we go up above a pH about 6.5, then most of the iron decouples from the chelate, the organic material, and it becomes rust. So above pH 6.5, almost none of the iron from iron EDTA is available. So in the greenhouse industry, many growers are incorporating now some iron DTPA or EDHA, different types of chelates that have greater solubility at high pH. So if you run into problems with one of your customers having deficiencies at a high pH, what should you do? Well, we'll go into that in a moment. So if the pH is low in your mix, any iron form, pretty much at any concentration, is going to provide adequate iron. And part of the reason is that your peat in your mix is actually an iron fertilizer when pH is low. Okay? But when we've got a high pH, then the iron form and concentration matter a lot. And this iron EDDHA form is more expensive but very soluble at a high pH, is going to avoid having deficiency symptoms. So one of the common situations in our growing substrates is our pH goes too high. Right? And one option is a foliar application, but that's only going to get iron into the leaves that happen to be on the plant at the time. The most effective way to go is with a soil drench of iron EDDHA, and here's our recommended rate, which would give us about 22.5 parts per million of iron. So iron EDDHA is a very, very effective tool to get out of trouble very quickly. And so this is showing 10 days after a soil application, and that grower has now got a saleable crop as opposed to something they're going to toss into the dump pile. At high pH, we get all kinds of other issues that can also arise. The most common one is iron deficiency. Anyone got an idea what this might be? It's an impatience crop here. It's got thick leaves, distorted tops. It looks a bit like insect damage, but it's not. It's a nutrient. It's a micronutrient.
Magnesium?
Magnesium? No. Magnesium is in the chlorophyll molecule, so it would be chlorosis.
Yeah.
Okay. It looks green because the grower is actually applying plenty of iron in there. Okay, it's boron deficiency. Okay, so boron is in the growing point. Calcium deficiency, boron deficiency look very, very similar, and they give us distorted growth. Okay. So other deficiencies can happen at high pH. Okay, so one of the challenges with pH management is there's a lot of different factors that are involved. Fertilizer type, water alkalinity, the plant species even, whether we're using nitrate or ammonium fertilizer, the acidity of our peat or bark, coconut core, whatever. Okay, we're just going to focus on lime and substrate here. So why do we apply lime? Well, it buffers pH, corrects pH, and it also supplies some calcium magnesium. And so when we look at the effect of liming our mix, then there's three R's that are important. One of them is how reactive is the lime source you're using. Because every lime source, every lime brine, every place quarry that it's come from has got a little different personality and how reactive it is. The requirement of the substrate. So every batch of bark or peat is going to have a little different lime requirement. And then the other concept that people are not as familiar with often is residual lime buffering. That's the unreacted lime that stops pH from dropping over time. Okay, so we've got, I'm not going to go into this very in any details in your notes, we've got hydrated lime, calcium hydroxide, or calcium magnesium hydroxide, very fast reacting, used in plugs especially, calcitic and dolomitic carbonate limes, which are both very reactive if they're fine particles, but will be slow acting if they're coarse particles. And so when they're very fine, and for a greenhouse that means really fine, so that most of the particles are passing a 200 mesh screen, then we'll use those on a short-term crop. And a coarse lime where we've got most particles bigger than 100 mesh are going to be there to provide residual buffering. So they're not going to react so much at the start, but they'll react later in the crop if they're not too big. So here's an example. This is a marigold crop here. And about 3 weeks, 4 weeks into the growing cycle, then these plants started showing some browning points on the leaf margins on older leaves. Okay, any idea what this might be? It's not an excess of fertilizer per se. It's a toxicity. Low pH, right. Okay, so it's iron and manganese toxicity on an iron efficient crop. Okay, so marigolds and geraniums are got some of your canaries in coal mine for iron manganese toxicity. So what happened was, in this case, this grower was using a limestone that was too coarse. The pH only climbed up very slowly. The iron manganese was too soluble then and got taken up to a toxic level. And if we look at this limestone compared with a whole bunch of other limes, so you know, one of the things we do with all of our research industry partners is we get lots of materials and then kind of do a consumer reports comparison between them. And so one of the kind of comparisons is doing a survey of limestones in our industry. And this is comparing all of those limestones in terms of how much do they bounce up pH after a week. And you can see that this case study lime is very unreactive. It didn't push pH up very much beyond our control here, our peak perlite pH of around 3.7. Okay? Whereas we've got some other limes that are a lot more reactive. Okay? So why and how does limestone react? We look at mixing in some lime into a mix, and this is time after we've mixed it. Then we start with an initial pH, which is just the pH of our substrate. We end up with some equilibrium stable pH at the end, and there are a bunch of factors that are involved in how quickly it'll react and where it ends up. So I'll just take a couple of examples. For examples, is temperature and moisture. If you've got a batch of mix coming out of Canada in the wintertime, then the reaction rate is going to, and it's baled, so it's very dry, the reaction rate is going to be very slow. Okay, so you deliver that mix to a grower in somewhere in the US, they thaw out the bale, put their plants into it. It's very likely that the pH is going to be starting out low. You get a call. It's underlined, but actually it's just not had time to react. Okay, so there's a bunch of factors that are involved in this reactivity. So let's start with one of them, which is one of your most important ones in terms of selecting a lime source, which is the particle size. So again, this is time after mixing the limestone in, and then this is the pH bounce that we get relative to the finest lime. So here we've got very fine limestone, very quick pH correction here from the acidity of the peat and perlite and bark. Here we've got a coarse lime, and here we've got a very coarse lime. And one of the things that happens with a very coarse limestone is if the particles are too big, they get coated with organics, with iron and other oxides, and they never actually react. Okay, so there's a sweet spot for the most reactive limes and also limes that are going to give us some buffering. Okay, if they're bigger than this 850 microns, bigger than 20 mesh, then they'll get very, very little reaction. So one of the things that we can do here in Florida is there's a commercial lab that I've worked with for probably 15 years, polyanalytical labs. Other labs could do exactly the same job, but no QAL is set up to do this. If you send them a limestone, they will go through, put it through sieves, and they can give you a distribution of what that lime is and how reactive that limestone is going to be. Okay? And so this is all relative. A value of 1 would mean that this lime is as reactive as a lab-grade calcium carbonate. If it's 0, it doesn't push up pH at all. And so the finer the lime, coarse, fine, the more reactive it is. There's not actually that much difference between calcitic and dolomitic limestone. Just switching from one to the other does not give you much change in reactivity. The important thing is how fine it is. If it's fine, it'll react quickly. If it's coarse, it'll react very slowly.
Okay, so you can test yourself with your own lime and substrate, or you can send in a limestone into a lab for analysis. And so in the greenhouse industry, we're basically looking at, if it gets to a stable pH in a week, it's highly reactive. Some are reactive in 2 weeks, and it'll be a slow-acting limestone if it takes more than 4 weeks. If you're dealing with trees, then the relevant time would change.
Paul?
Yeah?
Do you have any customers or growers or anybody that might be blending some of these different
things? Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. So we've got two very different things. We've talked about lime reaction, which is you've got some acidic bark or some acidic peat, and you want to get up to a pH of around 6 or 5.5 or whatever your customer's looking for. That's a fine line. You'll get, then the other thing that we'll talk about now is buffering to pH change, stopping that pH to drop again over time. And for that, you want a coarser lime. Sometimes you're lucky enough to have one limestone that's got a wide distribution of particle sizes, so you can get away with it. But in other cases, people will actually take two different limes for two different purposes.
Paul, quickly, are the fast-acting limes like Solucal, are they applicable for greenhouse use?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, and they're also used as a corrective material as well. Like we'll use, for example, flowable limestone products. As,
okay.
For whatever reason, the lime hopper got stuck in the mixing line, and you can potentially go back in with some of these flowable or very fine products. So what happens when we add lime into a mix? We add more and more limestone here. Well, we're only going to get to a certain pH level, and then it just reaches equilibrium. There's only so much of that lime that will react. Okay? So what is actually happening is we've got this proportion here in burgundy of what lime has reacted, and then we're just adding more and more solid stuff into our mix. So this unreacted lime is what we call residual lime. It's what's left over. Okay? And why do we care about that? Well, here we've got an experiment where for several weeks we grew some impatiens, a bedding plant, in a container. We started the same pH, but we had two different limestones. We had an acid reaction fertilizer high in ammonium, and if we didn't have any residual lime, pH drops. If we have some residual lime in there, there's resistance to that pH dropping. Okay. So if you have a long-term crop, then providing some residual lime in your mix is going to give you a more resilient kind of product for your customer. Okay. So it becomes very important for pH buffering. And in contrast, here we've got three different mixes, none of which had residual lime. And it's coconut core, coconut fiber, or it's a coarse or a fine sphagnum peat, so either a very blonde peat or a very decomposed peat. And we just don't have a lot of CEC in our mix. So the best way to give a buffered, pH buffered product for your customer is having some residual limestone in it. Okay, that's important. We can test the residual lime, how much residual lime is in your mix. And what we do there is we put some of the growing mix with its limestone into a beaker, and we add acid, and we've got a closed top. It reacts with the limestone, makes carbon dioxide, and we can measure how much CO2 gas is produced, and that tells us how much unreacted calcium carbonate's in the mix. Good. So if you want to add residual lime in your mix, it's in this sweet spot, it's this 60 to 20 mesh range. That's what provides the buffering. Okay. Components vary in their lime requirement because of their pH levels. Peat and bark batches will vary in their lime requirement. The more decomposed they are, the more lime they're going to require. And why does the cation exchange of those substrates, why does that matter? Well, it's because cation exchange from different batches of peat or bark are going to affect how buffered they are to pH change. And so we add in calcium or potassium into our mix, then it's going to interact with the exchange sites on the peat. So what the typical thing is for a growing media company is that they will figure out how much lime they're going to add based on the pH of the batch of mix that they're working with. Right? So we get a more acidic batch of pea from a different bog, we add more lime in. And that's a good starting point. But what we're trying to do is we're trying to, when we measure pH in our mix, we're only measuring the protons, the acid that's in solution. There's a whole bunch more acid that's on the peat, okay, which we don't measure when we do a soil test. And so here are three different peats, or three different barks. Okay, I deal mostly with peat. Here's one which has got every one of these triangles is an exchange site. Okay, so this would be, these would have the same number of exchange sites. This would have a higher number of exchange sites. So we call this, this might be a blonde peat, and this might be a decomposed peat. This could be a high cation exchange capacity peat. This, these would be low to moderate ones. Okay, and here we already have some of the acid has gone away because we have, based on the bog that it came from, it's already got some other cations other than acid on the exchange sites. This one doesn't have those cations on it, so we call this high base saturation. This one, just a standard low base saturation. And this would be high CEC. So how much lime would we need? It would be low, medium, and high to neutralize the acidity that's on those peats. Okay, so the only way to really know how much limestone you need is to run a batch test. Okay, there are some different lab techniques that, that can speed up the process, but basically you get a new pile, you get a new peat bog that you're harvesting, then you end up having to run batch tests to see how much limestone is needed. There is another way that cation exchange capacity comes in, and it also affects some of the technical calls that you'll get with growing mixes. And this is the relationship between the fertilizer level in your mix and the pH in your mix. So here we've got leaching out with pure water, more and more water being leached out. Okay? And this is the EC level, electrical conductivity, the salt level, nutrient level. Here we've got the pH. So if we put in a fertilizer charge and we put in some limestone, we start at a pH of 6.3, okay, and we've got an EC of 2. So we leach out that EC, then the pH goes up. Okay? And now the grower is sitting at pH 7.2 with a low EC and gets in touch with you saying that you overlined the mix. Okay? But what's actually happening is as we leach out that mix, it's washing out some cations and it is displacing some acid from the soil solution and the pH goes up. Okay? So you deliver a perfectly good product to your customer. And then they over-apply water, leach it all out, there's lots of rainfall, or they're just over-applying irrigation. pH goes up, EC goes down, and it's going to be your fault, right? So just one other aspect to this is that which of those cations, which kind of fertilizer goes most tightly onto the exchange sites, it's calcium. That's the one that gets most tightly down in there, okay? So if we add fertilizer back into our mix, then we push the pH back down. Okay? So this is a very common situation, probably the most common situation in propagation of greenhouse nursery plants, is that we've got lots of use of mist, lots of use of water, or it's not doing a good job managing water. The pH goes high, the EC goes low, we can measure lots of leachate out there. You add fertilizer back in, and the pH will go down. Okay? So there's a close relationship there. Okay, so I'm going to finish here, take our messages. We want to match our substrate and lime to start with pH of 6. Different substrates vary in their CEC, and therefore how much lime they need. limestone's all different, their reactivity, or how much is left as residual lime, and we want to match our lime rate with our growing substrate. And with that, thanks again to our partners, many of whom are here in this room. Thank you.
Talk about adding fertilizer. You're talking about adding the greenhouse environment and liquid fertilizer, not as dry fertilizer, but the dry fertilizer might have lime.
The same principles apply with top dressing, for example, with granular fertilizer.
Okay.
But not necessarily with, for example, blue chip, right. Urea chain kind of product. Because when you have some of those products, one of the first stages, if you top dress with a urea chain product, sometimes pH will go up initially as it converts into ammonium. Okay, so this mineralize that there's formation of urea hydrolysis, pH goes up, converts into ammonium, plant takes up the ammonium, pH goes back down again. So basically, if you took any granular fertilizer that did not have lime incorporated into it,
right,
or was not a urea chain kind of a product, then what I was saying applied just as well as with a water-soluble fertilizer. It also applies for a controlled-release fertilizer, which is basically just a water-soluble fertilizer with a plastic coating.
Organic fertilizer.
fertilizers and controlled release fertilizers for spiking of salts in the mix with them being stored. I've mentioned one project that we did, a research project that to me was very interesting this spring, related to storage and when we get released out of controlled release fertilizers is, I'm from New Zealand, All Blacks, and so outside of the US, there's quite widespread use of double-coated controlled release fertilizer products. And they're very interesting products to work with. I know Everest has one, there's probably some from other companies as well. And so they will wax the outer coating on that controlled release fertilizer prill. So they don't release for between about 4 to 8 weeks. And that's temperature based. And then that outer coating breaks down and the nutrients start coming out of the prill just like a regular osmocote or neutrocote type of product. And so the reason we were using that was that a grower can incorporate that double-coated material into their growing mix. The greenhouse grower can use water-soluble fertilizers as though there was no CRF in the potting mix, but it starts releasing for their customer. There are other companies that I work with that are exporting mix from Europe where they don't want to have any nutrient release for a period of time until it's actually over here on this side of the pond. So that's where that same product starts to be somewhat useful, get around the problems of things changing during storage. All right, so
very good.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for the opportunity.